eyes can't find the sun. There's nothing wild as far as I can see. Then my heart turns to Alaska and freedom on the run. I can hear her spirit calling me.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was, of course, John Denver singing To the Wild Country. It's from a series of songs he wrote about Alaska, our nation's last wilderness on this earth, a magnet for the would-be pioneers of our day. Beginning in 2002, that ilk included a modern-day homesteading family led by a mysterious and charismatic man, Robert Hale, who called himself Papa Pilgrim, who brought his wife and their 15 children to live a life apart from others in Alaska. At least that's what people thought. Instead, their presence quickly rattled a cage of the ghost town settlement of McCarthy, where they curried friends, singled out foes, namely anyone associated with or sympathetic to the U.S. Park Service, and garnered a fair share of headlines in the Anchorage Daily News. Their story is one of prodigy, piety, and perfidy. Joining us now from Homer, Alaska, is Tom Kazaya. He's a former Anchorage Daily News reporter who covered the saga of that family, their wrangles with the National Park Service, and finally, the revelations of their dark and painful life together. His new book is called Pilgrim's Wilderness. It is a top 10 recommended book for July by Barnes & Noble and a top 10 best book of July by the Apple Store. Welcome to the show, Tom Kazaya.
Hi, thanks.
First, could you tell us about the region of Alaska where most of the story takes place? For me, in reading the book, the land itself was a main character in this story.
Well, the Wrangell Mountains are a huge mountain range in the eastern part of the state, southeastern, not in southeast Alaska, which is that panhandle, but in the southeast corner of the main body of the state. It has, you know, I think between Alaska and Canada and the adjacent, you know, Logan area, there's a 9 peaks over 16,000 feet. Anyway, there's a lot of big peaks and way, you know, way bigger than anything in the lower 48, big ice-capped mountains. And the whole area in Alaska was part of the 1980 Lands Act, that which Congress created, you know, 55 million acres in new parks. And the park in the Wrangells, the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, is pretty much the size of Switzerland, and there's only one little community at the heart of it, which is at the end of what was once a copper railroad, mining railroad. Railroad was torn out, and now it's a long, thin gravel road that goes to this half ghost town of McCarthy, and that's the only place inside this gigantic national park under a looming 16,000 foot Mount Blackburn.
It was interesting that really the easiest time to get around this area is in the winter.
Well, it's a tough country to travel because, especially because the rivers coming down off of those ice fields are so turbulent. You can hear the stand on them, and you can actually hear boulders getting pushed along, and they're very, silty gray water for the most part. So you can't, and ice cold, really dangerous to try to cross on foot in the summer. They had a interesting. The old miners in those areas would build cable tram cars in the winter, and then they could get back and forth in the summer across these rivers. But in the winter, of course, when it's frozen, you can travel, and the people would get on snow machines and move out. And that was when the Pilgrim family arrived in McCarthy. Was in the dead of winter.
The people who live there in McCarthy, a special breed, too. All kinds of, it's a small number of people, but lots of different kinds of people.
Well, by the 1970s, it was starting to revive, you know, a little bit at least. It was essentially abandoned in the 30s after the Kennecott Copper Mine closed and they started tearing the railroad out. The town of McCarthy was set up just down the mountain from the Kennecott mines, and it was kind of the service town, with the saloons and such. Mm-hmm. And once it went back to being a ghost town, it was actually a fairly congenial place for people to settle in the bush, because there was private land left over, and there was, you know, good resources to live off of. And a rough gravel road that would get you in and out. And there was also, you know, all this old material left behind by Kennecott, you know, the big steel cables that they'd use to run the tram cars down the mountains from the mine itself, and windows and lumber. And so, it, you know, they were kind of scavenging off the lost civilization as well as off the land. And it became a somewhat thriving little town. And then the national park came in. It was an obvious choice, one of the top choices for among the new national parks for Alaska. And the people who had kind of untrammeled access to the wilderness weren't all that excited about having to get permits now and have the government tell them where they could go and when they needed to not go places. And so it was really a whole generation of trying to figure out how to live inside a national park. And one important point to make is that the Alaska parks were intentionally different from parks in the lower 48, in that Congress decided that they wanted to preserve the rural frontier lifestyle as well as the rural frontier landscape. So people who lived in or adjacent to the parks were given access to hunting and fishing seasons, special seasons, to provide for their subsistence. They had certain rights of access if they had land inside the park that maybe the Park Service wouldn't want to grant in the lower 48 parks. And so there was a kind of balancing act that Congress tried to strike here that was part political compromise and part ideal, you know, social idealism about there's something magical about being able to go out and build a cabin. And, you know, you can't do that in the national park, but if you've got land out there, they weren't going to try to roust you out of there the way they had in a lot of parks in the lower 48. At least that was the principle going in, but there's a lot of ingrained attitudes within the park, and there's a lot of people with chips on their shoulders about the federal government within the community, and it creates a potentially volatile situation. And Papa Pilgrim and his 15 children walked right into that situation one generation after the parks had been created, and really everything kind of blew up at that point.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Tom Kazaya. He's the author of a new book. It's called Pilgrim's Wilderness, A True Story of Faith and Madness on the Alaska Frontier. We've just been talking about McCarthy, Alaska, where a lot of the story takes place. When did you first cross paths with the Hale family, Tom?
Well, I had a small cabin out in the McCarthy area. So I was hearing about this family from friends out there for about a year, but I live in Homer. I was a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. At one point, finally, I heard that Papa Pilgrim had gotten on a bulldozer and had cleared open a road from this copper mine that his family had bought 13 miles out deeper into the wilderness beyond McCarthy, had opened up the road all the way down to McCarthy, and the Park Service was apoplectic because you don't just get on a bulldozer and drive through a national park. But some people in the community were really supporting him as that he was exercising his rights, because it was in fact an old wagon road that used to wind up that valley. It had washed out, grown over. He was kind of making up the route as he went along, but there was in fact a historic route. And so if the Park Service was supposed to be acknowledging the past as well as the present, then they should perhaps recognize his right to do this. And so that was kind of how the issue was framed. And I figured it sounded like a good story for the newspaper at that point.
The people of McCarthy at first mostly welcomed the Hale family. I mean, they were odd. They had 15 kids and they dressed in kind of that pioneer type of gingham type homemade clothes. Actually, for them, it was a lot of just cast off, but
they had that prairie look.
The prairie look. No unshaven faces. The girls' hair long. What were their range in ages at that point? About 29, well, I know the oldest.
Yeah, 29 was the oldest. But they had one baby was born out there. You know, I think pretty much the first baby in that region since copper mining days in the 20s and 30s. So. So that was the full range, you know, the 15th child was born out there.
So the people of McCarthy at first mostly welcomed them. They were odd, but they had a charm about them that blended in at first.
Well, the first day they showed up in town, Papa was asking questions about real estate and sort of being, you know, making some shrewd questions about the area. But then he sort of summoned the kids and they all came piling into the lodge and they all had musical instruments and started playing. And they were quite an impressive family band and very charming to sort of think of them as coming out of the woods and playing this kind of music. And people, everyone in town sort of got the word and came over on their snow machines to hear these newcomers. And in the back of their minds, they're thinking, man, if these guys really do settle here, they'll double the winter population in town.
And have a dance band to boot.
But we'll have more fun with them around, maybe. So this could be a good thing. And they would go out of their way to be really helpful. And but there was sort of this mystery, you know. Was it like, I guess John Gardner, the novelist, said there's two plots basically, right? There's the hero goes on a journey or a stranger comes to town. Hmm. And this was certainly the latter, you know. This family showed up. Nobody really knew who they were, but they were definitely different. But you know, McCarthy kind of prided itself on being a refuge for the eccentrics.
I can't wait to get into that backstory, but first I wanted to talk about the Park Service relationship with the Hale family, with the Pilgrim family. The Park Service pretty much stayed out. I was interested to read about that, how they kept a hands-off thing. They didn't want to bother anybody. They weren't necessarily welcome in the town until only recently at that point. People didn't even like seeing them show up. There was a lot of derision over that. But Papa Pilgrim, Robert Hale, he had an immediate aversion to any contact with the Park Service.
He warned them, I guess he had his sons warn the rangers who came to visit about the dogs being dangerous and stay back and wouldn't talk to them. Said, talk to us through we know the lodge owner. If you want to get any messages to us, send them through him. And the park ranger said, hey, you know, you're now a big landholder up. You're the only one up in this McCarthy Creek Valley, and we need to let you know what the rules are, you know, for having a 420 acres inside this national park. And he wanted nothing to do with it. He was persuaded that they were going to, you know, be out to get him somehow. And soon enough, that became the fact.
My guest is Tom Kazaya. He's author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, A True Story of Faith and Madness on the Alaska Frontier. When we return, we'll get into that past of Robert Hale. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Protected by the snow. When I need some time alone, it's a place where I can go. 'Cause I share my dreams with the caribou and the whisper of the wind. And I long to be in Glacier Bay again. I wanna go home to Alaska.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Lee Greenwood singing I Want to Go Home to Alaska. We're talking about one family that hoped and prayed that Alaska would be the home that had eluded them, but their story was complicated by the mental illness of the father, who zealously interpreted the Bible to justify complete control over his wife and their children, to justify years of physical abuse of his family and sexual abuse of some of his children. Joining us now is former Anchorage Daily News reporter Tom Kazaya, who covered the story of the Pilgrims as they were known in Alaska, and who has written a new book about how they pitted neighbor against neighbor even as their own internal world unraveled. The name of the book, Pilgrim's Wilderness, A True Story of Faith and Madness on the Alaska Frontier. Tom Kazaya, can you talk about Robert Hale's background? It's kind of creepy. It's how many historical notes it touches on.
You remember the Zelig movie? He kind of shows up.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so it's interesting the way his background started to come out, you know, because in the process of fighting the Park Service, he was becoming a really big folk hero, you know, way beyond the boundaries of McCarthy. People were, you know, flocking to his cause. And I talked my way into going up to visit him, rode by horseback out to the homestead and spent the night out there with his family. And while we were talking, he kind of gave me the key to his past because he was still a mystery man. He said his father was an FBI agent in Texas, and I thought, well, that's interesting, you know, that considering how anti-government he was. But he said that he had never talked to reporters before he let me come out because I had a cabin out there, but he'd never talked to reporters because a reporter had written something so awful about his own father, full of lies. And so, you know, I kind of nodded sympathetically and wrote down, check IB Hale internet, you know, when I got back, when I checked to see if anybody had written about his father, whose name was IB Hale. Yes, there was. The person who'd written about him was Seymour Hersh, one of the country's leading investigative reporters who'd written about him in a book about the Kennedy administration, The Dark Side of Camelot. And suddenly I was like, you know, tumbling down the rabbit hole at this point. I called my editor and said, it's going to take a little longer to finish this story than I thought. So it turns out that I.B. Hale, his father, was an All-American football player from Texas Christian the year Texas Christian won the national football championship. His roommate was Davey O'Brien, for whom the you know quarterback of the year award is named. And he went into the FBI, became a close friend of J. Edgar Hoover's. Bobby Hale grew up with a twin in great, you know, affluence in Fort Worth. And he was very charismatic and narcissistic, I guess, as a teenager. And he, as a 17-year-old, he pried away the daughter of John Connolly, who would soon be the governor of Texas, and eloped with her. 3 weeks later, she was dead of a mysterious gunshot wound to the head. Bobby was present at the time, and a coroner's verdict said it was suicide, but apparently at least driven to it, if not trigger-pulled by him. It was just all very mysterious and hushed up. You know, Bobby was at her funeral, of course, with his father, and LBJ was there as one of the pallbearers. And then it's thing after thing. After that, the FBI files show a stakeout on the mobster girlfriend of John Kennedy, and they see Bobby and his brother Billy in their father's car breaking into her apartment for mysterious reasons. Never was sorted out what was going on there, but by that time, I.B. Hale was head of General Dynamics security, and Seymour Hersh in his book was speculating that there was some sort of blackmail of the president afoot, you know, privately. None of that was ever proved, but it was a sort of, nothing was ever proved. What were these guys doing in her apartment?
And they were just teenagers at the time.
Just as teenagers at that point. Then he then he went on the road, and he said it was because of the death of his teenage bride that sent him off as a pilgrim. And he shows up in, you know, the Maharishi and rural communes in Oregon, Haight-Ashbury, even having dinner with Charles Manson at one point, and, you know, wandering through South America, and then finally finds Jesus. And also at that point had found Karina Hale, his third or fourth wife, and depending how you measure that. And she was just a 16-year-old runaway. He took up with her and said, this is the woman God told him at that point, apparently, through the means of LSD or something at that time, mm-hmm. that she was going to give him 21 children. And so they headed to the mountains of New Mexico and started their strange life.
She had some connections, too, in Hollywood. She wasn't without means. Her mother was married to a somewhat prominent producer.
That's right, and they they ended up, more of this Zelig stuff, they ended up for more than 20 years on a high mountain, you know, ranch, rough country up in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains of New Mexico that was owned by Jack Nicholson, who had gotten connected to the area at the time of Easy Rider. And they had arranged that through Karina's stepfather. But, of course, to the outside world, Bob Hale, or Preacher Bob, as he was now calling himself after his religious conversion, said it was that he had been so eloquent in writing to this movie star that about their subsistence lifestyle and their pious ways that he had persuaded him to let them live there for free.
Now, they were able to live there for quite a long time without raising any suspicions, but as the family expanded, they started to really, really struggle just to feed those kids.
It was hard, and there were suspicions. There were especially suspicions of cabin break-ins around the area where the only things that were taken were things that didn't require electricity. And it was, it was a tough life for them up there as more and more summer homes started to sprout up in the mountains around them. They began to feel pressed and feel like a need for a new and pure frontier. And that's how Alaska came up.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Tom Keziah. He's author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, A True Story of Faith and Madness on the Alaska Frontier. If you have any questions or comments for Tom, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Bobby Hale, Robert Hale, had already turned to religion by the time, well, around the time he met his wife, his last wife. When did he become a zealot? When did he become sort of messianic in his stature, at least in his own eyes?
Well, I guess that sort of evolved over time in those New Mexico mountains. He seemed to get stranger and stranger. He wouldn't go along with the kids learning anything.
Anything.
Just, well, like, other than they had two books in their household. One was the King James Bible, and the other was Pilgrim's Progress, that, 17th century allegory of Christian salvation. And that was kind of the information they were allowed about the world. At one point, early on, they were learning to read a little bit, but then Father turned against it he wouldn't let them read anymore and sent the oldest daughter, Elisheba, out to dump the school books in the bottom of the hole where they dumped their waste every morning. It was her job to carry out the bucket at the end of the night. And so for a few weeks afterwards, each time she'd carry that bucket out and dump it in the hole, she'd watch her only formal education subsiding down in the sludge, and that was the end of learning to read. She was the one able to read just a little bit. None of the other kids, it turned out, could read at all, but nobody knew that. And it's important to remember that in Alaska, they were kind of iconic. They were like the purest of the folk musicians coming out of the wilderness. There was some sort of righteousness in their battle with the national park over their rights to live in the park, and they were flying. There were, lines of airplanes flying supplies up to them to confound the Park Service blockade. And so it was that sort of contrast between the image and the deeply secret reality that made this such a sort of fascinating turn of events.
We've brought up the their music a couple times. Let's listen to a cut from, they had a CD. We can only listen to a little bit of it. It's called Heaven, and this is called the Pilgrim Family Minstrels, right?
Right. Right.
Okay.
Child, I heard about heaven. Oh, I wondered if it could be true that there was imagined eternal, all somewhere out there beyond the blue.
That was Heaven from the Pilgrim Family Minstrels.
They made quite a presentation on stage.
I bet. Big group.
Big group. All, you know, the way they dressed and the way they looked. And they're all sort of handsome, very handsome family. And mm-hmm. little kids would come out and start clogging along to the music. And Papa was the showman.
Did you ever see them perform?
Yeah, a little bit. And then I in their cabin, too, they performed several times when I was around.
A couple of the kids, at least, one for sure, you call him a prodigy. He played the mandolin.
That was Jerusalem, a she. She was great.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was just, she was quick-fingered, and she was, everyone sort of, the musicians would single out her. They went down to Portland, Oregon, and did when they made that CD, as they were kind of reaching the peak of their fame, and mm-hmm. musicians down there were very impressed with them, and they said that they were kind of like the, you know, Carter family coming out of the backwoods. They didn't really want to give them too many tips because they didn't want to spoil what was just natural in their presentation.
But even though they were exposed to all of this, he kept the family very close together. The kids really weren't allowed to talk to anybody on their own.
They could get out and talk, but they were not one-on-one. He usually liked them to be talking in groups so they could report back on each other.
What happened? When did they start to lose the support of the community? Was it during the blockade? I'm trying to remember now. It seemed like no matter how down and out they would get, even when they had the smashed windshield and they were trying to cross into Canada at one point to get to Oregon, someone found them and helped them out. Someone was always helping them out.
He was brilliant at sort of deploying his kids and creating sympathy. And they were a sympathetic bunch. People were always drawn to them. There were just so many stories that started coming out of the woodwork eventually about, you know, family after family that had met them and taken them in and, you know, for 48 hours had this great vision of this family that had fallen out of heaven. And then something would go wrong and he'd pull this family away. You really needed enemies, you know? That's what we now can realize, that he and the Park Service being enemy number one, combined with the, you know, social welfare agencies, mm-hmm. He basically tied his, you know, it was like wartime footing for his kids. And so there was no, it would brook no dissent. And it tied everyone together more tightly, that it was sort of God and Jesus and Papa and us against the sinful world.
It probably wasn't by accident that they lived in two states that are the least concerned at the time, New Mexico. And I think Alaska still has one of the freest educational systems. In other words, they don't require it.
Yeah, you pretty much just say, yeah, I got this. Thanks.
Yeah.
And that's about all you need to do.
No one follows up on a family like that to make sure they're teaching them anything.
Not an education. You know, there could be complaints about parenting that might or might not get followed up on, and probably not when you live 13 miles beyond a wilderness ghost town in the middle of a national park the size of Switzerland. Nobody's going to want to go up there on horseback as a single social worker.
So there's the blockade. The National Park Service has instituted a blockade. They're airlifting in supplies. What went awry at that point for them?
Well, I think the biggest thing, well, it was a lot of little things. Mm-hmm. They were taking more and more, getting more and more into businesses in the little town of McCarthy, which in the summer has a trickle of tourists, a growing number of tourists who would come out to see the national park. And the pilgrims started to insert themselves into every potential economic nook and, you know, kind of pushing others aside. And their sort of aggressive, sort of passive-aggressive attitude toward their neighbors began to really wear. Plus, they had they needed a place in town where they could run their businesses out of, and because they couldn't move their supplies up their, you know, so-called road, they felt like they were trapped there. So they just sort of piled up their supplies in this camp in the middle of town, and people started to get pretty annoyed because they didn't have any land. They were just doing it on a on a right-of-way. I mean, it's because the town is kind of growing back in trees. You didn't. It might have looked like the middle of the woods, but it was really somebody's right-of-way into a cabin. And eventually, you know, it took about a year, but eventually they had antagonized everybody in town, including their strongest supporters. And there was like a march with a behind a bulldozer. It was like mining town, mining camp justice, you know, to tell them, okay, Pilgrim family, it's time for you to move. It was a big showdown, and when that was over, the family truly was isolated, and it was almost, you know, kind of their darkest hour.
You begin the book with the escape of some of Elisheba and a couple of her sisters, I believe, in the middle of the winter, and it's then you do the flashback. When was it at that point of their isolation that
there was a really hard winter after they got expelled from town?
Okay,
yeah, that's when it was really bad. Their resources were low. They were struggling out there in the homestead, and you know, 30 below, dark country. And then they stumbled by luck into this family, this other great big Christian family, fundamentalist Christian family, but much more grounded than Papa Pilgrim, not in McCarthy, but along in a little town on the way into Anchorage. This family took them in for the winter season, and you know, fed their horses, and they could tell this family needed help. And suddenly, these kids found themselves in the midst of another family with quite a few children, mm-hmm. all their own ages, and they all sort of read the Bible together and believed things, but this other family would actually talk about it and say, is this the right way to raise children, or should we do it that way? And, you know, I wonder what this book means by this. It wasn't just Papa lecturing. And so the two patriarchs started to really get at it. And there's, you know, a long and dramatic few months to follow, ending with Papa exploding and tearing his family away, kind of really going off the deep end at that point. They went back out into the wilderness. He, you know, attacked and beat his oldest daughter in really awful ways that was kind of eventually figured into criminal indictments against him. But even then, she couldn't bring herself to tell her brothers and sisters what had happened. It was really hard. She had been abused by him for years in secret, and he had such psychological control over everyone that even in a one-room cabin, they weren't aware of how badly she was being sexually abused.
I'm talking with Tom Keziah. He's author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, A True Story of Faith and Madness on the Alaska Frontier. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
It's 40 below. I mushed from Point Barrow through a blizzard of snow. Been out prospecting for 2 years or so. Pulled into Fairbanks, the city was a boom. So I took a little stroll to the Red Dog Saloon.
Yes, he took a little.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Of course, that's Johnny Cash singing When It's Springtime in Alaska. We're talking this hour with journalist and author Tom Keziah, whose new book, Pilgrim's Wilderness, recalls the life and times of a modern-day homesteading family that on the surface personified the American mythical pioneer, but behind the scenes represented every possible family dysfunction. Tom, the children we mentioned earlier were terribly ignorant, but it's hard to imagine. You describe a scene in the book where somebody's telling them that they look like a little family of penguins the way they're all lined up, and the kids did not know what penguins were.
Right. The tourist kind of went down the line, big to small. Do you know, or small to big, do you know what a penguin is? No. Nope. And she was kind of amazed when she got to the oldest one, and they'd never heard of it. They knew nature so well where they lived. They could ride horses and fix engines, and they knew how to find all the game in the valley, and they were great hunters and all of that. But once the birds flew out of the valley, they had no idea where they went or what happened. You know, so it was just that kind of a life for them. And that mythology that they presented was made it a fascinating story for me as a journalist, but it got so dark that I really didn't think that I could imagine doing a book about them, despite all the sort of fascinating twists and turns in the story, until I really finally at the end got to know the kids and learned how they escaped and learned how resilient they were and how they were dealing with what they'd gone through and emerging from it. Story ended up having a kind of really upturn, happy, maybe overstating it, but it had a very positive ending. And I thought, now this is a story that I could really tell. You know, they go through the dark and they come out the other side.
And they, by and large, they're survivors, ironically, in part because of their faith in God. They did have that constant, even though it had been twisted by their father.
Isn't that amazing that they would keep their faith and really be rescued by it? In some ways, it's amazing. In other ways, I think if somebody had come along, a family had come along to rescue them that didn't share that sort of fundamentalist belief, they probably wouldn't have been able to relate at all. And so in a way, they had a halfway house. Sort of Christian halfway house.
Yeah, the phrase you used in the book that way. Yes, it was a bridge for them.
Yeah, exactly, it worked for them, and something more, secular probably wouldn't have worked at that point.
What do we know of Corina Rose Hale during this time, and that he was eventually indicted, and by the way, died denying. Isn't that right?
He died in jail. One of his many secrets was how sick he was, secrets at least from the outside world. Corina, she was known as Country Rose. She was definitely an ambiguous situation. She was horribly abused. She was, taken in by him when he was 33 and she was 16 and, molded into the mom that he wanted. But also she was really rabidly into living that country lifestyle. She kind of pushed that in a big way and idealized that and was kind of a rebel herself. So she kind of got drawn into this deeper and deeper. She was beaten all the time as a way of, saving her soul was the message to the kids. And she knew what was going on in the end with her oldest daughter and her husband, and she went along with that in order to, as she said, protect the others. When the kids finally escaped and finally were taken by their new, protector father to the state troopers and turned in Papa Pilgrim, the prosecutor had to decide what to do with the mother and decided, that she was really more victim than perpetrator. And but it was a tough call for him, and she's I found her a sympathetic character, but it's like the Bob Woodward rule about people who will talk to you. She was talking to me, and she was a great storyteller, and had remorse and humor about things or other things that went on in their lives, and she's a sympathetic person.
But in the end, does not live with any of the children. Was not allowed to keep any of the children.
Yeah, there's actually still some fighting going on about what's going to happen to the youngest children. But she definitely step back once this other family had come in and rescued them. For sure. Mm-hmm.
Did the older children stay friendly with her?
I can't even
imagine what the relationship was like with her, living with her during those times when he was there.
You mean in the cabin?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think that, she was the mom, and she helped them escape when she saw that things had gone too far, and she was part of the end. She wasn't trying to, you know, talk them out of it. And she, so she feels like she and everyone else who, you know, had been in, had some role with him, had turned against him by the end. It was, he was completely isolated, had no supporters, clearly.
One
who believed his story that he was the innocent one in all of this.
His, and undiagnosed, was he ever diagnosed with any mental illness per se, or do people just speculate on what was wrong?
No, he was never diagnosed, because he never went to trial, and he was in jail for a long time, and there was some question about whether there'd be a trial. In the end, there was just, he decided to plead out and to, you know, rape and incest and kidnapping and physical assaults, all pretty much around the oldest daughter, who was quite the hero in sort of standing up to him and rallying her brothers and sisters and escaping into the wilderness. And that dramatic escape that you described on Snow Machine was really, in some ways, the most amazing part of the story. And so she really kind of made the escape happen. You know, she was the one.
She was so traumatized because he, from the beginning, had told her that what he was doing, that this was all part of being a virgin and part of being
the special daughter.
The special daughter, and that this was allowed.
If not only allowed, but God wanted it,
yeah.
He would find signs, describe the way an elk had come down the mountain in New Mexico, and if we found an elk antler with seven tines, it means God wants you to do this with me, because I had a dream last night, and oh, sure enough, there comes an antler with seven tines, and you know, just constantly, and because there was no other story in their life, it was all, this was very believable, and the only really important thing to them in the world was their eternal souls. That was what they had been raised to. Everything was sort of centered around saving their souls for eternity, and rebelling against their father would, you know, incur the wrath of God.
And so when the time came, and when the other family, they're trying to say, what happened? What's going on? Is there anything you want to tell us? She didn't even know how to tell him at first.
She couldn't tell him, even after escaping. You know, the hard part was for her to escape and to risk that wrath of God, her eternal damnation, but she had to do it. And then she moved in with that other family. She still, it was like months before she was able to finally talk. You know, there was another series of incidents that finally precipitated her talking. And as soon as she talked, the family went, oh, gee, you know, wow.
Went
to the state troopers, and the troopers went out in a helicopter. Papa Pilgrim had vanished. You know, he was a great wilderness guy. There was a 10-day manhunt to track him down.
He did have a lot of illnesses, though. It's kind of amazing how he kept it up.
I know. Yeah, it was, to realize afterwards how sick he was. He kind of stumbled along in jail for a couple of years, and then, but once he was convicted, he just kind of gave up and crumbled. Within 6 months, he was dead.
You write about your own life in the context of this story. Your wife had first introduced you to McCarthy, where she owned some land, I guess. It was in her family. She'd bought it. Was it easy to integrate yourself into the story? I know after years in the newspaper business, and you too, that's what we're taught not to do.
Right, yeah. It was hard, you know, to break out of that. But it was important, it seemed like, for a couple of reasons. One, because it, explained how I got in to see Papa as a local and not as a reporter. And it gave me a chance to do scenes in the first person. So as a writer, you know, you like to have certain scenes where you actually are physically describing the place as you're experiencing at the time. Also, I thought that by adding a layer of my story, and it's a very small layer, it doesn't really, you know...
It's not obtrusive at all.
Right. But it was important to look at the world as I look at it, which is not as a fundamentalist Christian, because there was a kind of internal logic to the family story that they sort of see it to this day as a kind of Christian parable of danger and redemption, of being led through the, you know, valley of the shadow of death and coming out the other side with their faith intact. So it's a great story, but it's not really the full story. It's not as I saw it, and not the story I wanted to tell. But I had to be very respectful of that story to tell it as it occurred to them.
And you were going through your own struggles.
Well, yeah, my wife was ill, and she was dying of cancer at the time, and so I think that in writing about that a little bit and how that brought the end to our sort of pioneer dream of being out there, it kind of added to the general lost world feeling of that whole part of the country, to the mood of the story, but I hope not obtrusively.
Not at all. How did... I read in an interview that in Alaska, when you would tell people they'd say, "Hey, what are you working on?" You'd tell them you're working on a book about the Hale family, and they would know instantly what you were talking about.
Well, like right now, it's taking us an hour to try to explain what the story was all about. And I said I never really developed an elevator pitch for this book because, while I was working on it, I'd say, "What are you doing?" And I'd say, "I'm telling the inside story of the Pilgrim family," and that's all I have to say. Their eyes get wide, and they say, "Whoa, I want to read that one."
But for the rest of us out
but
here...
But the rest of you, where to start?
It is. Because by the way, listeners, we haven't even scratched the surface. There's still plenty of side stories in there that we haven't even touched on. How has the book been received in Alaska?
It's only
been out a few weeks.
It's only been out really a week or so, and so it's flying off the shelves up here. But we'll see what reaction is. I'm going to go out and do a reading in McCarthy and in Kennecott in a couple of in August, and that will be interesting. I think it's Kevlar optional for the because I'm writing about the people out there, and they're everybody's strong opinions out there, so. But I was sort of unique in able to write about it as an insider and an outsider both.
What was it like sitting in that courtroom at the end after he pleaded guilty to avoid a trial? And then
there was a 2-day sentencing hearing.
Yeah.
That was where everything finally came tumbling out because each of the children was given time, all the time they wanted to testify about what their father had done to them, meant to them. To address him directly if they chose. And it was just heartrending and dramatic because most of the details we hadn't heard at that point in public. I'd heard, as a reporter, I'd been hearing little bits and pieces off the record, but that was very dramatic. And then at the end we heard Papa Pilgrim himself speak for 3 hours and give a long soliloquy about his life and times and how everybody was out to get him.
It must have been heartbreaking to watch those little kids do that.
It was heartbreaking, but it was also really inspiring, I've got to say, as they sort of spoke about grace and forgiveness, and they seemed to have worked through impossible things in their own minds, and clearly the catharsis of speaking in public about it was important to them.
By any estimation, all the kids are very bright.
Yeah, they're bright. Like I say,
I mean, how lucky to have 15 kids, and they were learning to read. And
their father was, in his own way, really brilliant. Clearly a great mind. I mean, he was really good at reading people, so that he had, whether you were an environmentalist or a early Tea Party guy or whatever your position was, he would. Have you in his pocket within 5 minutes of sort of telling you what you needed to hear and be impressed that this very different person understands me.
The children now, most of them are grown up, they're working, and some of them have married, including Elisheba, which was the best part of all, I think.
Had a happy, happy ending, yeah. Yeah, and it's been hard since... for some of the kids, Elisheba's doing great, and it's a good place to end, like a Jane Austen novel, to end with a couple of weddings, including two weddings into that family that rescued them.
Which was kind of funny, since when the parents first met the boys, they said there is no way they're ever going to get within a country mile of these girls.
Right, keep them distant.
What a book to write. Thank you so much for talking with us about it today, Tom Kazaya. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. Thanks for your interest. It's hard to project it into Ohio, but if I can do that and make it real, then I will have accomplished what I set out to do with the book.
It's Tom Kazaya. He is a journalist and author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, a true story of faith and madness on the Alaskan frontier. And as I mentioned early on in the show, it is on some top 10 lists, including the Barnes & Noble and Apple. So check it out. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.